Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. Articles entitled 37 Hours of Terror in the Dark Cell. What's it like to spend endless time shackled in chains in a pitch-black cell in a primitive prison with only nameless terrors to keep you company? Here's one woman's report. Text by Marilyn Taylor. Photographs by Jeff Kaida. My imagination saw the blackness that held me as a living fiend, growing more dangerous by the second. It was a crusher that gained strength as it drained my spirit and stole my oxygen. Lying on my back on a cold, flat iron grate, I fought to breathe. Then the stabbing returned, little needle stabs all over the exposed parts of my body. I swiped at them, dreading the vermin I imagined clinging to me. Blindly groping, I used a cold cave wall to pull myself up. I tried to inhale deeply, but my imagination was on a rampage, and I had become my own enemy. It was time for me to get out of the dark cell. 37 hours earlier, I became the first prisoner to be confined in the Yuma Territorial Prison's dark cell since the facility closed in 1909. The idea was to make my stay, 48 hours, as close as possible to the experience of prisoners who were thrown into the cell as punishment. They wore only their underwear. I wore shorts, a t-shirt, and a sweatshirt. They ate bread and drank water. I also had a loaf of bread and a water jug. They were shackled. So was I. Going in, I was sure I could manage my worst problems. I have to fight for breath in dark spaces, and idle time is a bane on my mind. Otherwise, bugs, snakes, scorpions? Not likely. Ghosts? Hardly. What's 48 hours? A mere 2 days with a beginning and an end. Time simply had to move along, I reasoned. Now I'm mortified by my naivety. I meant to stay as a lark, a writing exercise. Let's watch where the imagination goes in darkness. As cavalierly as I approached the confinement, I got what I deserved, an unsettling bout with self-demoralization. Opened in 1876, the Yuma Territorial Prison contained more than 3,000 men and women during its 33-year history. Called the Desert Alcatraz, it claimed the lives of more than 100 prisoners, many of whom lie buried in a cemetery just beyond the prison on a mound overlooking the flowing Colorado River. The prison's dark cell was for inmates who broke the rules. Blasted out of a mountainside and floored with caliche and concrete, it was a 15-foot by 15-foot cave closed off from the outside by two thick strap iron gates, an outer gate that led to an open walkway, and an inner gate that closed off the cell. There were no beds, no pillows, no toilets, nothing but the prisoners themselves. Their only source of air and light was a small shaft in the ceiling's rock ceiling. For infractions ranging from talking after taps to drinking rot gut, prisoners were either chained and shackled to the dark cell's stone walls or thrown into his cage. Constructed in the middle of the dark cell, the cage was a grilled strap iron pen 5 feet high, 10 feet long, and 8 feet wide. As many as 14 men were locked in it at any given time for periods ranging from 4 to 60 days. Certain I could endure a mere 2 days, I began my dark cell stay at 7 a.m. one day in mid-March. Cheryl Steenerson, public information officer for the Arizona State Parks Department, shackled my right ankle, and Joe Masterson, park ranger, brought me the bread and water. Locking the gates behind them, they promised to check on me at 5 p.m. that day, 7 a.m. the next morning, and at 5 p.m. the night before my release. Since 1961, the prison has operated as an Arizona State Historical Park. Under normal circumstances, Steenerson told me, tours for the prison's hundreds of daily visitors would have included a walk through the dark cell. During my stay, she said, the dark cell and I would be locked away from sightseers. The first hours were easy. As the sun rose higher, the cell was brightened by a beam of bluish light coming through the air shaft, which illuminated an 8-foot by 10-foot floor grate, the only remains of the cage. As those first daylight hours went by in the cell, which appeared to me as if washed in moonlight, I plotted a series of activities I engaged in whenever my rear got too sore and my body too cold from sitting or laying on the concrete floor. I marched in place, rattling my chain with each step. I practiced my golf swing, imagining an iron in my hands. I did knee bends and sit-ups. I created lists in my mind and examined them at length. Favorite books, favorite cities, favorite movies, milestones in my daughter's life, past boyfriends. When the park rangers walked by with groups of visitors, I could hear them talk about the dark cell and how men were stuffed into the cage, about cruel guards who may have dropped snakes and scorpions through the air shaft onto prisoners. How would the visitors react if I rattled my chains, I thought. I'd give them a real fright. Later, as the hours crawled by, I actually did it to amuse myself and pass the time. By late afternoon, the light began to fade, and the cave darkened by the minute. While I still had some light, I inspected the walls. During the Great Depression, transients and homeless families used the then-abandoned prison for shelter while they waited for permission to cross the border into California. Their names and dates are etched into the cave walls, and I read them one by one. Then I took up a stone and carved my own initials, taunting myself all the while with the thought that my initials were assigned to the cave ghosts, that my soul now was theirs. It was then that my imagination began to work against me. It found shadowy shapes on the cave walls and named them. There was Devil Dog with fangs and a snarling, wide-open mouth, and the tragic comic man whose lips were twisted in a lunatic's grin while his eyes sagged in despair. I peered up at the ceiling near the cell door and wished I hadn't. It was covered with abandoned spiderwebs, which held wispy skeletons that looked disturbingly like the shells of dead black widows. At 5 p.m., Park Manager Masterson came to say goodnight. The park was closing, she said, and everyone, every single park employee, was going home. She reminded me that I had a police radio in case of an emergency. I nodded, the fear of being completely alone striking me for the first time. Seated and resting against the wall, I watched the light finally disappear altogether. Soon I could see nothing, not even my own hands before my face, and time had turned cruel. It broke itself into parts, seconds that built slowly to minutes, and minutes that crawled to hours, and hours that seemed as still as the darkness of the cell. It was in the darkness that night that I had my first bout with the stabbing sensation on the skin of my legs, arms, and face. By then, my body was coated with fine caliche dust, which turned my hair to crackling straw. I told myself it was the tail-like dust pinching me as it sank into my dry pores. Despairing that I would spend the black night alone, I took off my T-shirt, gnawed a hole in it with my teeth, and ripped off a wide section. I folded it and, lying down on the cold floor next to the cage grate, placed it under my head. My mind drifted to what might have become sleep when I was jolted wide awake by a rumble, a train. As it got closer, the cell vibrated with sound so maddeningly my brain was beset with a shaking clanging that remained long after the roaring beast had passed. Now, weary but alert, my imagination renewed its assault by settling on the darkened shaft. The local newspaper in Yuma had published a story about my adventure in advance of the event. Over and over that first night, my imagination saw a jokester jump over the prison wall, climb on top of the dark cell, and drop something down the shaft. It wouldn't matter what was dropped. In the darkness, the smallest pebble might as well be a hairy scorpion or a scurrying river rat. Shivering with cold, I waited in tortuous tedium the entire night for it. The drop never came, but fear of it robbed my sleep. When the cell began to brighten, 24 hours had passed, 12 of them in total darkness. At 7 a.m., Masterson returned to check on my water and bread supply. Little of either had been touched. My mood was foul, and my spirits had sunk. I had thought the hardest part of the stay would be the first night, but I was wrong. The 24 hours ahead of me, most of which I would spend alone in darkness, sent me into the deepest, blackest despair. For endless hours the second day, I walked, ate bread, drank water, walked, lay down, sat down, stood up, sat down, walked, thought, and drifted in and out of minutes of sleep. I prayed for Masterson to come again, signaling that it was 5 p.m., and there would be only 14 more hours until my release. Angry and frustrated by the slow crawl of time, I kicked the cell wall and fought back tears as I waited. Finally, I heard her unlock the gate. "Can I get you anything?" she asked. No, I said, biting my lip. Well, okay, we'll see you in the morning. I couldn't believe it. I hated myself, my one chance to leave before the darkness set in, and I didn't take it. I would be alone again with the enemy, myself, in that heavy, horrid blackness. Then the cell lost its light again, and the stabbing returned. My imagination focused on the nature of ghosts and identified them as invisible demons whose silent chatter drove the living mad. My imagination saw these ghosts still chained inside the cage at the center of the cell. It showed me the frantic, flailing arms of tracked men, human beings who had endured as long as 2 months in this hell, men reaching out of the cage to stab me and pull me in. Fighting panic, I lay down on this cage's iron floor grate. Odd as it seems now, I thought this would immunize me against my imagination, that the act itself would help me reclaim my grip. I lay there on the grate, staring at the darkness. I don't know how long enough for the iron bars to force their pattern into my back. When I stood up, I knew it was over. I couldn't breathe. The harder I tried, the faster I panted. I'd lost the power to calm myself. Then, just as I was about to reach for the police radio, I heard scuffling outside the cell. "Who's there?" I yelled. "No one's supposed to be here. It's me, Marilyn. It's Jeff." Jeff Kaida, the photographer, Arizona Highways, had assigned to the dark cell story. "Jeff, I gotta get out of here," I yelled. "You gotta find Cheryl Steenerson right now and get me out." He didn't argue. In a matter of minutes, Cheryl was there and I was out. It was 8 p.m. I'd been locked up only 37 hours. In the morning, we revisited the cell for a photo shoot, and the park rangers kidded me about letting ghosts drive me out. "I'll tell you something, though. All joking aside," one ranger said, "little kids will go into the dark cell and come out saying they were pinched. They tell me somebody was in there who reached out and pinched them on their legs and arms. It's weird that it's just the children. It's not just the children. It's the naive fools, too. They're just as much fodder for hungry spirits and imagination run amok." And this concludes 37 Hours of Terror in the Dark Cell. The next article is entitled Sheepmen versus Cattlemen. Text by Dean Smith, illustrations by Phil Boatwright. All the elements of explosive confrontation came together that sunny afternoon of June 24th, 1882, on St. John's dusty main street. Catholics versus Mormons, Hispanics versus Anglos, New Mexican versus Texans, and, most emotional of all, sheepmen versus cattlemen. Three defiant young Greer brothers and five of their ranch hands faced an angry mob of Hispanic sheepherders spilling into the street in front of Sol Bar's Hotel. Insults were flung in Spanish and English, and sunlight glinted off six guns and rifles. Then shots rang out. Both sides claimed the other fired first. Blood spurted, and the Greers scattered for cover. The Battle of San Juan's Day, the climax of a range war that rivaled the famed Earp Clanton and Graham Tewksbury feuds in both bitterness and loss of life, was underway. It was a slow-burning fuse that ignited the St. John's Warfare, a fuse that was lit during the Mexican War of 1846-48 when Thomas Lacy Greer was wounded by a Mexican bullet. It festered in his body, along with the dislike of Mexicans, as long as he lived. Greer returned to Texas after being discharged from the Army, was converted to the Mormon faith, became a wealthy cattleman, and in 1877 brought his wife and eight children, along with their cattle and horses, to northeastern Arizona Territory. Their arrival, preceded by 3 years, the more publicized coming of David King Udall and his band of Mormon settlers from Utah. The Greers bought a ranch 18 miles northwest of the tiny village of St. John's in 1878, and were soon running cattle on 1 million acres of grassland in newly created Apache County. This incursion of gringos and their cattle aroused indignation in the breasts of Hispanic sheepmen who were there first, since 1866, in fact. It was in that year that Juan Candelaria drove his flock of 750 Merinos from Cubero, New Mexico, and established a ranch near present-day Concho. Not long after the Greers arrived, the New Mexicans retaliated by bringing in 10,000 more sheep, which often strayed onto the Greer range and cropped the once lush grass down to ground level. And then, in 1880 and 81, a tidal wave of 80,000 more woolies surged in, making much of the range unusable for raising cattle. During the winter of 1881-82, the Greer cattle were scattered to the four winds by the sheepherders. Many were stolen, and not more than half of the animals were recovered. To the Greers, the goal of the Mexican herders seemed clear, to drive them and their newcomer Anglo neighbors out of the county. Thomas Lacy Greer and his five sturdy sons had no intention of letting that happen. They fought back, riding out to raid sheep camps, scatter the flocks, and frighten the herders out of their wits. Nate Greer, eldest of the sons, recalled later that he caught a herder trying to run off Greer livestock. I gave him a choice. I'd shoot him on the spot or at earmark, cut a notch from his ear, as with cattle, so I could identify him if we ever met again. He decided to let me cut his ear. After that incident and many other clashes, both sides were spoiling for a showdown. It came on June 24th, a gala holiday in the heavily Hispanic community of St. John's. To celebrate San Juan's Day, the locals had spared no expense, bringing in musicians and acrobats and staging a bullfight with a matador direct from Mexico City. In an apparent gesture of conciliation, they invited the Greer boys, their father had died a year earlier, to ride in for the celebration and the cattle sale which was to follow. Nate, 25, Dick, 18, and Harris, 16, accepted the invitation with some trepidation and brought with them several $100 with which to buy cattle for their depleted herd. They also bought their guns, plenty of ammunition, and five of their cowboys also armed just in case. Heading the welcoming committee was none other than Saul Barth, St. John's leading businessman who had married a pretty Mexican woman and was regarded as the spokesman for the sheepmen. He led the Greer party to the arena where the acrobats were performing and urged the cattlemen to enjoy themselves. What happened next has been reported in a confusing and conflicting variety of ways. One version is that a Greer cowboy fired his pistol as a prank while a high-wire acrobat was in midair, causing him to fall. Another had the visitors boisterously shooting up the town. Neither seems likely in view of the Greer's well-founded fear that an ambush might be brewing. Here is Nate Greer's account as recorded by his nephew, Earl C. Brown. While all of this, the acrobatics, was going on, we noticed that quite a few of the local men were going in and out of a nearby saloon. Nearly all were armed, and they were getting rowdy and excitable. We left to get something to eat, and I looked out on the main street and saw 15 or 20 men coming our way, all with six guns and rifles. I told the others we had better move fast, split up, and work our way out of town. Joe Woods, Frank Drew, Hi Hatch, and Jeff Tribbett went out the back door of the store, headed for my brother Gilbert's house to get our horses. My brothers Harris and Richard and I, with James Vaughn, headed for a vacant house. We were nearly there when the shooting started. Most of the oncoming men were in front of the Barth Hotel. We started shooting back, and some of them went inside the hotel and started shooting from the upper story windows. The four of us in the house had only our six guns, plenty of bullets in our belts, but our shooting wasn't too effective at that distance. Not long after we got in the house, James Vaughn was hit by a rifle shot from the hotel window. It knocked him down on the floor. Then Harris received a bullet in his hand. We wrapped it up in my neckerchief, and he was able to keep shooting. But we were not able to help James, and he died in a few minutes. Bullets whined both ways for 15 or 20 minutes, with agonizing outcries from the hotel and street attesting to the accuracy of the Greer gunfire. The Mexican gunners were equally deadly, and both Hatch and Tribbett, a former Greer slave, were wounded by rifle fire as they made a dash for safety with the Greer horses. The frenzied attackers made one desperate raid in force in the house where the three brothers lay in wait, but the Greers beat it back. They came so close that we couldn't miss them unless we shut our eyes and aimed at the sky, Nat Greer later declared. Screaming in anger and frustration, the attackers fell back. Maurice Kildare, who wrote a lurid story of the battle for a Western pulp magazine based on his interviews with Nate and Dick Greer, declared that six Mexicans had been killed and many others wounded up to that moment in the deadly battle. If that were true, Barth and the sheepmen hushed up their losses. No Hispanic deaths were reported in the several newspaper accounts of the affair. There was one more killing yet to come. Mormon elder Nathan Tenney, a friend of the Greers, strode bravely between the battle lines carrying a white flag and demanded the right to arrange a truce. Mr. Tenney came into the house and said we'd better give up, Nate Greer said in recounting the episode to Errol Brown, or we surely all would be killed. He said, as far as he knew, we had hit only one of our enemies and hadn't killed any of them. Tenney was leading the four out of the house onto the street when a rifle bullet from upstairs in the Barth Hotel slammed into his head and killed him instantly. Soon after, Deputy Sheriff Tom Perez arrived and ordered the Greers to give up, which they did. The bloody battle of San Juan's day was over. Arizona Territory journalism in 1882 was not notable for its objectivity. Consider this front-page story in the Tucson, Arizona Citizen of July 9, 1882, which was the first and most detailed report of the battle. It possibly was written in part by Saul Barth and was headlined, Bloody War, How St. John's Day Was Celebrated in St. John's. The 24th of June being a day for festivities among Mexican Catholics, everybody was having a good time and witnessing an acrobatic performance when everyone was startled by the report of firearms. To make a long story short, 7 or 8 Mormon cowboys came into town for the purpose of running the town and enacting another Mountain Meadows massacre. A fight took place in the streets. Rifle bullets and pistol balls were flying through the air. The fight finally got too hot for the Mormons, and 3 or 4, one wounded, lit out in somewhat of a hurry. The other 4, headed by Nate Greer, took possession of an adobe house and kept up the fight. Of the 4 in the house, James Vaughn was killed, and Dixie Greer, actually Harris Greer, wounded through the left hand. Nathan C. Tenney, a prominent Mormon and former bishop, was shot through the head and instantly killed. The Greer brothers then gave themselves up, and all is quiet, but far-seeing ones are prognosticating more serious trouble in the near future. Prescott's Arizona Miner reprinted the item 5 days later, adding that Bishop Tenney, well known here, now sleeps beneath the cover of clay. Perhaps a stray bullet hit him in the head. The item ended with this comment, The Greers are under arrest and no doubt will be tried at this term of court, and then we have but one side of the story. An honest and accurate admission, indeed. The Citizen's final statement was equally accurate. There was much more serious trouble to come. The St. John's gun battle was not the first and far from the last confrontation of Hispanic sheepmen and Anglo cattlemen in Apache County during the bloody 1880s. Lorenzo Hubbell, the famed Indian trader, was sheriff of the county at the time of the San Juan's Day shootout. In a later memoir written for the Sheriff magazine, Hubbell declared that, I'd scarcely been elected sheriff before war broke out between the sheep and cattlemen all over this section of the territory. The cattlemen were Texans, and they opened bloody warfare upon all the poor, ignorant Mexicans, Indians, and Spanish Americans who owned the sheep. He settled the war in 3 years, he claimed, by jailing the Texans whenever possible. I was shot at from ambush a dozen times, and my home has been converted into a veritable fort. For one solid year, not a member of my family went to bed except behind barricaded doors and windows. Then came Hubbell's most astounding statement. I settled the war, but it cost the lives of nearly 300 men, including 5 of my deputies. The sheep and cattlemen shot it out with each other, and some 295 were killed. No documentation exists to verify the number of casualties in the bitter struggle of more than a decade, but no other participant or historian has estimated losses even approaching 300. Some Greer family members believe as many as 50 lost their lives before an uneasy peace was restored. If that figure is accurate, this little-known warfare killed almost as many men as did the long and bloody Pleasant Valley War, Graham's versus Tewksbury, a few years later. One of the Apache County deaths came at the hands of Dick Greer a few months after the St. John shootout. With Joe Woods and Jeff Tribbett, he raided a sheep camp and was confronted by the well-armed Hispanic herder. Greer was quicker on the draw, and his adversary fell lifeless. After burying the herder in a shallow grave and running sheep over it to tamp down the earth, the 3 rode to Holbrook to report the incident to Judge Frank Watron. With the aid of Commodore Perry Owens, soon to become one of Apache County's most powerful sheriffs, the 3 were released without a trial. And what was the aftermath of the Battle of San Juan's Day? The 3 Greer brothers who had fought it up in the adobe house were charged with wounding sheepman Francisco Defala and assault with intent to commit murder. None of their adversaries were ever tried for the killing of Vaughn and Tenney. The St. John's Saloon was converted into a courtroom for the trial of the Greers, and a host of vengeful Hispanics crowded in to seek places on the jury. However, armed Mormons stood along the saloon walls to ensure a fair proceeding and to be available for selection to the jury. Because territorial law required jury members to be U.S. citizens and to speak English, few of the Hispanics were qualified to serve. When selection was completed, the jury was thus heavily Mormon, and it promptly found the Greers not guilty. Much to the chagrin of the sheepmen, the three were free to return to their ranch, there to plan strategy for continuing the range war. The rawhide, tough Greer boys ultimately settled down to become prosperous Apache County ranchers, community leaders, and faithful servants of their church. Dick's son was elected Navajo County attorney, and other progeny held similar places of trust. The Greer boys' later lives were as peaceful as their early years had been violent. Two graves in St. John's West Side Cemetery bear mute evidence to the bloodshed of that violent June 24th. On one gravestone, in honor of Nathan C. Tenney, who died while saving life and making peace. On the other, farewell, James H. Vaughn, murdered by a Mexican mob, June 24, 1882. Author's note. Because it was not a passionate feud between families with well-known personalities on both sides, the Apache County Range War never has caught the fancy of novelists and folklorists as did the Earp Clanton and Graham Tewksbury warfare. But it was no less bloody. Before the decade of violence was spent, probably as many as 50 men were killed, although many of the casualties were unrecorded. There were no good guys or bad guys in this Western thriller, only people of different cultures striving to eke out a living in an inhospitable land. And this concludes Sheepmen vs. Cattlemen. This also concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.